I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, ahoy, everybody. Welcome to the Talking Simpsons Season 9 Wrap-Up. I am one of your hosts for this one, a knight in Scully's service, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Henry Gilbert, and I'm leaving the show because I signed a new 2-year multi-million dollar development deal with Castle Rock Entertainment.
And that does that count as Disney? They're separate from Disney, right?
They haven't been bought yet by Disney.
But no. Still, that's sweet development money. But yes, welcome. We do one of these at the end of every season, talking about what happened in the news during that season. We also talk about our favorite and least favorite episodes. And our favorite character from the season, the MVP, as it were. And we've been doing this since season 2, and they're all on the Patreon at the $5 level, so you can go back in time and hear news from all of those different seasons if you just go back on the Patreon.
Yeah, tons of great stuff on there. This one is slightly after we finished season 9, but in our defense, we did just spend 8 days in Los Angeles Recording cool podcasts.
And wait till you hear all the good stuff that's going to be coming out of that trip.
Yeah,
oh boy.
So many
it's coming
awesome
so
things.
Soon.
Yeah, you'll hear the first, you'll hear them very soon. You're listening to this whenever you listen to it, but yes.
You'll say, is this outer space or Talking Simpsons? Because all I see are stars.
But yeah, season 9, what a season of Simpsons it was.
Our last mega long season, right?
Yeah, I believe it's the last 25 episode season. It's the only season to have an episode, at least one episode show run by each showrunner who ever ran the show.
Yeah, the last Merkin show, the last show with Mike Reese as a writer and showrunner for that episode, or those two episodes.
Yeah, and the last of Bill and Josh as well, and then Mike Scully overseeing the majority of it. Like, yeah, you got, a big part of it was that they had a clip show and Joy of Sec that Merkin did. Then they had the two more from the Gene and Reese little room, and then just the leftovers from. I also like production season 9 lasts so long because I think they still produced 25 while still getting 5 leftovers in 9. So like we don't even get into production season 10 like till Treehouse, and then 2 more after that from 9. Yeah,
I think we're getting to the era where there are just so many holdovers every year. There's usually just a few, but by the time you get into like the late teens, the seasons are just like half holdovers.
Yeah. And I think, you can blame sports for that as well. That Simpsons are always on Sunday, and so are baseball and football. So it moves stuff sometimes, which is a little kind of sucky, but yeah, season 9 was an interesting one for the Simpsons. I collected a ton of news. There was so much news that happened on the Simpsons. You may remember in previous ones of these, I'm like, there was a lot of news going on.
You had to scour.
Yeah, not the case between the dates of the start of September 1997 and the end of August 1998, the year that we will say covers the full span of season 9. And so this is all the news that happened during that. And so we'll start off at the top that, Mike Scully officially became the showrunner while David X. Cohen would leave. David S. Cohen would change that out for an X and join up with Matt Groening on Futurama. But so many more things happened. Starting in August, Film Roman, the production company for The Simpsons, they got a new CEO named David Pritchard. He would leave within a year from that position and would eventually be arrested for defrauding investors in 2014.
So there's a reason why he was only on for a year.
Well, it seems like he's kind of an underhanded guy. Yeah, this looking into David Pritchard, it's a pretty amazing story that he and some other rich guys who could say they worked on The Simpsons and other shows.
From one of the producers of The Simpsons.
They started a show, they started a production company called Gigapix, and their big movie was going to be Oz 3D, a Wizard of Oz retelling with 3D animation. But really, it was a front for a telemarketing scheme to get low-income investors to sign up for the new Pixar, and like, this is going to be the next Pixar.
It's not a scheme, you just give them your credit card number and they enter you into a lottery.
So they stole a shitload of money from people, and David Pritchard would eventually be sentenced to a 5-year term, which he is reaching the end of soon by my count. But the last news on him was the sentencing for 5 years back in 2015. So that's what's happened to Film Roman.
I'm sure they're doing well now after getting rid of him.
So September 21st, during the airing of the season premiere of The City of New York versus Homer Simpson, they reveal what people have been waiting all summer summer to find out who would win the Pepsi sweepstakes to get themselves the real Simpsons house.
Oh, I forgot Pepsi was involved.
In Las Vegas, yeah.
How did you enter this contest? I totally forget.
You get a code in your in a Pepsi product. This also included like other Yum brand things. You'd get a code, and then you tune into the season premiere to find out if you won. And actually, I have a clip of when they announced the winner.
Grab your virtual Simpsons game pieces. If your number matches the number on the screen, you've just won a life-size replica of the Simpsons house.
Woo-hoo!
Built by Kaufman and Broad. Congratulations.
Kaufman and Broad paid a lot for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cool idea, but winning property brings with it a lot of issues like taxes and also having to move to Las Vegas.
Yes, and you own a house that kids want to break into.
Yeah.
Not unlike how kids were trying to find get the trampoline at the Simpsons house.
You own a house with like props glued to the wall.
Yeah, and a garish house that once you see it in real life, you're like, good Lord, this house. your eyeballs would just break living there.
I think they had to immediately repaint it to meet like neighborhood codes.
So Mental Floss, with an article written by Jake Rosen, has a amazing breakdown of everything that happened. But the quick version is that on the 21st, they had that thing that announced it with the number on screen. By the 24th, they released a news story that they're like, no one's claimed this. If you want it, take a look. But whoever got the winning game piece never claimed it. And so by December, they had to do their backup plan, which is pick randomly from one of the free entrants. And the winner was a woman named Barbara Howard, who lived in like rural Kentucky. The story they said is that they sent a limo to pick her up, but it literally couldn't go down the dirt road to her house with her emu farm. She really had an emu farm.
This is like a real Beverly Hillbillies situation here.
And of course, Barbara Howard didn't seem to give two craps about The Simpsons. Her kids did.
Oh.
And so she, instead of getting the house, was like, give me $75,000 instead, which I don't blame her. I think I'd have to take the house just for honor's sake. I couldn't tell people I didn't take it, but $75,000, man, that's pretty good. So she didn't take the house, so now they're just left with this house that the zoning board in the area is like, you can't have this open to tourists. Like, people live here. We don't want that. So then the Kaufman and Broad people have to resell the house to somebody. They resell to people as is, they said, and then they repainted it all. The whole story is amazing, but so that's what happened with the Simpsons house during season 9.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking one thing that's missing from the Universal Simpsons Park is that there should be, like a tour of the house. They should just build the house on the lot. Because I was thinking of when you go to the One Piece Museum, you can like just walk through the ship. They have like a facsimile of the interior of the ship from One Piece.
I was thinking about how at Disneyland, you know, in crappy old Toontown, they do have like, here's Mickey's house, here's Minnie's house, walk around in it. Like, isn't this cool? The Simpsons should have that kind of thing, even though you couldn't be allowed to touch anything because all people would do is steal props all day.
Yeah, there'd have to be like a guided tour through it. But I don't know how long they have left Universal. I got to go again before time's up.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it could be an in perpetuity thing, or it could be that's how it is with Spider-Man in Orlando. But yeah, you got to move fast. The ride's been there for 12 years now, and so but you know, Universal has an itchy trigger finger when it comes to killing off their rides.
I'm a podcast The Ride convert because can we talk about anything?
Folks, we have on Scott Gardner.
Yeah, from Podcast The Ride, and of course, creator of Moonbeam City, a great show. But I'm a recent convert to that podcast. And on the most recent one, or on one of the ones that released after we went to Universal, he was talking about how they recently made that ride a lot brighter.
Oh,
it came
really?
Up on the Back to the Future The Ride episode. So they said, oh, just last month they made The Simpsons ride a lot brighter, I've heard. Mm. So, and that was like in April or something. So,
I want to see that because it's a little dim. It was when we rode it just recently. It was a little dim. When I say recently, I mean a year ago.
Yeah. I want to go back.
So September 26th, Al Jean and Mike Reese's brand new TV show, Teen Angel, debuts on TGIF.
Uh-huh.
It'll run for 17 episodes before being canceled in February of 1998. And that would be the last thing Al Jean does that isn't Simpsons, pretty much.
The last thing Mike Reese does that isn't Simpsons.
Which, hey, I don't blame them. After working on a TGIF show with tons of Disney notes, why bother?
Yeah, they had ABC screw them over twice. So I can understand wanting to get out of the business.
Twice that we've heard of. That's the shows that got to be shown to humans. Like, think of all the things they tried to develop that never left it.
These hidden pilots.
So October 4th saw a major moment in Simpsons fandom. HarperCollins releases the first volume of The Simpsons, A Complete Guide to Our Favorite Family, a gift that many a Simpsons fan will receive for the next 20 years from family members.
I have that book from when I originally bought it that year, and I immediately regretted it because I'm like, wait a minute, I have this all on the internet, and it's actually more accurate. There's lots of mistakes in that first printing of the book. I mean, it's laid out very well. I liked it, like the layout
nice
and everything.
Design,
yeah. But I was like an alt-TV Simpsons reader and a reader of the episode capsules. I'm like, oh, well, I don't need a book anymore. Mm-hmm. The internet's my mega book.
Yeah, it's funny that like 2 years before, I very much valued my MST3K book that was kind of the same thing.
That is much better, though, because it has a unique essay on every episode from all the writers.
Yeah, that's
for,
true.
Except for Trace, I think. Maybe Trace is in the book, too.
No, Trace had quit by okay. six. So yeah. He was gone. I think, yeah, there are a lot of conspicuous absences in this book that was like written during production 7, I think.
Yeah, no Joel, of course. Mm-hmm. No other Josh Weinstein.
Yeah, but Jim Mallon, boy, get to hear all of him. Jim Mallon's was so dumb. It was him making fun of Kevin Murphy most of the time about how he's just a big guy.
I bought two of those, and I've had like almost everybody from Mystery Science Theater. I think every cast member except for Jim Mallon has signed my episode
really?
Guide because the three Rough Track guys came to IGN when the boss of Legend Films ran IGN for about 2 days. and then at a Cinematic Titanic show in 2009, I had all the rest of the people sign my book before
Amazing.
That. So I have one copy that's all dog-eared and ancient, and I can't open anymore, and that's the one that's signed, and I have one that's new and fresh, and then that's readable without an autograph in it.
Man, I'm jealous. Well, but yeah, the complete guide, I think I threw out mine in my move because it was so beaten up anyway. But a few Christmases ago, I got the most recent version of it that's like the giant red hardcover that's in a slip case that's like, you know, would break your bones if you dropped it on somebody. So they keep publishing it, and it was a giant hit. Like, it sold 400,000 copies that Christmas. Like, a huge hit. So, November 17th, speaking of Simpsons releases, saw the release of the only Simpsons video game of Season 9, Virtual Springfield.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, game.
Game. It's essentially, so think of the DVD menus. It's essentially that, but a game.
Yes, yeah. It's, it played like crap, but I clicked through it for hours and hours because I want to be sure I heard every single joke that you could possibly find in it. Because they did bury a lot of jokes deep in it. And
yeah.
Like 2 years ago, we interviewed Paul Provenzano, one of the executive producers on that game, about the making of it. It's an interesting story, you know?
Yeah, it's a fun virtual tour of Springfield back when we were kind of thinking, like, what did Springfield look like? But I think the game Simpsons Hit and Run did a much better job of just giving you a 3D Springfield to run around in.
I loved in Provenzano's story the story he tells of the developers finding out that you have to be able to walk in two directions, so they have to do it twice. But it was one of the earliest times that, you know, Gracie and Fox together worked on a real Simpsons game that was supposed to feel way more authentic. And also, though, this was a theme starting in Season 9. It was a Simpsons product not made for children, but for nerds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And still no writers from the show were working on the games. Yes.
I believe, yes, yeah. Though, that didn't stop the Simpsons voices from being in there, including our wonderful, beloved Troy McClure.
Yes.
Welcome to Springfield. I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me as town spokesman for such computer travel guides as Duluth, It'll Grow on You, and Suddenly Tulsa. Of course, we all know Springfield for its award-winning dandelions and as birthplace of the glove compartment. But that's merely scratching the surface of a place the great Calvin Coolidge once labeled a pea-sized town with lima bean-sized dreams. So warm up your clicking finger and let's explore a land the poets call Springfield,
yes, so
USA.
Potentially unheard Phil Hartman. And the my friend had the game, and you had the game too, right?
Yes.
He would say different movie titles like, you might remember me from this movie. And
yeah.
This movie.
You could hear the pause there in it. Yeah.
And also whenever he talks.
Yeah.
I love those old bit rates.
Oh, man. A mind blower. I was like, I'm walking through the world. Even though, like, if you look up the clip, there's maybe about 4 frames of animation per second in there. But hey, they're doing their best. They're doing their best.
I played a lot of the, so about 3 years ago, the day the Tentacle remake came out, and that game came out in 1993, and like all old PC games of the time, the voices were so compressed, because they all had to fit on one CD, hours and hours of dialogue. For some reason, they were able to clean all of them up so it sounds otherworldly. Like, I've never heard these voices this clean before in my life. It just, before they sounded like they were coming over a walkie-talkie, now it's like, this person is in the room with me. It's very eerie.
No one would bother to do this or waste their time with it at Disney now.
Yeah.
But somebody really should go back. Like, it's things most people haven't heard of Troy McClure talking are priceless. Like, and I believe Hutz has a little scene in it too. That's basically they expend all their guest star money right at the start. They're like, here's Troy McClure. You won't see him again.
No, he doesn't say much else than that, but odds are you might not have seen him.
Yes, yeah. It's just... On YouTube, you can pull up a walkthrough of it, since also it like runs on DOS, so you can't, I mean, if you even plugged it into any Windows, it wouldn't really play, I don't think. Next up, December 18th, Simpsons producer Steve Tompkins officially announces through Variety that he will be leaving The Simpsons to help run a brand new show they just sold to Fox with Eddie Murphy, The PJs.
All right, and Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein credit Steve for being one of the funniest writers in the room, who's only, what, credited for, like, one episode and one Treehouse segment, maybe?
Yeah.
So Milhouse Divided is his, right?
Yes, yeah. Though they credit him for so much, like he, like on Homer's Phobia, they talk up him a lot for his research of going to like Anvil-style gay bars.
And Alice Tompkins from The Critic is named after Steve Tompkins.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, because he wrote on The Critic too. This is now the second generation of Simpsons writers getting all of their deals, like selling all of their shows.
Get them while you can, boys. I mean, we are entering the second primetime comedy boom, which a lot of shows would eventually become unknowingly Adult Swim shows in the future. But because of the success of King of the Hill, the huge success of that show, we're seeing all these shows greenlit around this time, like the PJs, Mission Hill, which we'll talk about soon, Futurama, Oblongs, Baby Blues, again, all the Adult Swim shows you later watched.
Yeah, so many shows. February 19th at Pasadena's Animation Celebration, Matt Groening makes a shocking reveal that Michael Jackson wrote Do the Bartman.
And then we later found out it was his producer.
Yes. Yeah. Though he says that, I mean, you know, Michael Jackson wrote it.
Yeah.
He wrote it as much as he wrote anything.
Yeah.
But yes, as Matt Groening himself said, it was always amazing to me that no one ever found out that Michael Jackson wrote that song. He was a big fan of the show. And so you wouldn't be saying that now. But
yeah, what was Michael Jackson up to in 1998?
And I mean, you still think about the weirdness of Michael Jackson being like, I want to write songs for Bart Simpson's. I love Bart. It's like,
yeah,
you totally see when Al Jean says his reasoning for wanting to not share that episode anymore is that they feel like accessories to his criminal activity.
Yeah, it is propaganda. Pro Michael, it's cool to hang out with kids propaganda. And if in case you missed it, you could be new to the Patreon. We did a free episode about the documentary and the removal of Stark Raving Dad from different services and why we're totally on board with that. So check it out. It's not a fun thing to listen to.
Yeah.
But if you want to hear our sober thoughts about some serious stuff.
Me and Bob, the short version is me and Bob are pro-censorship. And we love
That's why
Big
I was
Brother.
We were both game critics for so long. It makes sense. Yeah.
But seriously, no. Like, we give real not-joke answers on that. All right, March 5th, 1998. And this is when Simpsons News is going to be getting hot and heavy for the next, 3 months. March 5th, Fox officially orders 13 episodes of Futurama, seeing it as a perfect companion to air next to The Simpsons, which they won't actually do. But, I mean, Futurama was clearly in development way before March of 1998.
Yeah,
but
like Matt and Dave Cohen were developing it for, 2 years. Basically.
Yes. But this was Fox officially signing the contract and saying, 13 episodes, here's your money, let's do it. March 12th is some of the very first public news, at least as far as insider newspaper Variety has, about the voices of The Simpsons are holding out for a raise from their $30,000 an episode and that they might be replaced. Because all their contracts are kind of running out in season 9, and they need to sign to new deals in season 10.
This was the first of, two contract disputes with the actors?
I mean, I'd say it's up to 3 or 4, but there will be another one. There's one in mid-2000s, and then there's one at about 2012, 13-ish. That's when Shearer said he was going to quit. Actually, that was more like 15. So I think it's every 7 to 10 years they have an argument over pay.
They were not being paid very well. well. They're being paid much better than us, but they have skills that no one can replace. So, I say pay them what they're worth. I think they even took a pay cut recently, right? I'm sure we talked about that.
Yes,
in the
to
past.
Continue, they took a pay cut just because Fox is like, we will probably cancel the show if you don't take a pay cut. And so they, part of their leverage, it sounded like, was telling the actors, you'll be responsible for all these people losing your jobs if you want more money.
Yeah. I guess part of the problem of having a legacy show that's very popular is it gets more expensive every year.
Well, though, I'll talk about this more in other news I found out. But I think one thing we never thought about why Simpsons was so attractive to Fox is that it was way, animation's expensive, but everything else is way cheaper than producing a live action show. Like, by they have a show that got equal ratings to most live action shows Fox did, and the actors get paid way less, way less. I mean, the Seinfeld actors were almost making they were almost making $1 million an episode by that point for a show that had, as I would say, as much of a cultural impact as Simpsons had.
Oh yeah, and did they all like stood in solidarity with each other, right, about getting paid?
Yes, yeah, they wanted it was a solidified movement for that. But yeah, so on March 12th is when they finally started making the fight public, and it was being talked about. But like, well, you can replace voice actors, can't you? And the cutoff is apparently the start of the fiscal year in April. Like, that's because that's when a production would officially start, at least for voicing lines for season 10. And so March 16th, it's announced that Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein are officially developing an animated series for the WB network called Brothers.
Oh, Brothers.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Good old Brothers.
Working to one of two working titles. I didn't know about the Brothers working title.
No, me neither. Not until that was what was printed in Variety. But yes, that this will later be called Mission Hill. After going through like at least one other name change, this is the Mission Hill series, which, oh man, I'm sure things are going to turn out really great for them and Warner Brothers.
They're the brightest stars of the Simpsons writing staff.
So April 2nd of 1998, it is announced that they have gotten a brand new deal for all the actors to stick around after even floating the idea of recasting people, which was at the time by everybody rejected. It's like, you can't replace Homer Simpson. You can't replace Ned.
We'll see what Disney thinks about that.
Well, you know, age might replace them.
Yeah.
But as Variety said at the time, an interesting thing that I is counter to what I had read. Now, I had read that it got everybody up to 100K. That is not the case according to this 1998 article on Variety, where they say unnamed source close to the matter, which I would bet is Harry Shearer,
yeah,
said that they upped it to 50,000 for season 10, 60,000 per episode at season 11, 70,000 per episode at season 12, and according to the sources, that they'll get $1 million bonus if the show can make it to 2005. It's clearly an impossibility that would happen.
They never thought it would go, 15 seasons?
Yeah.
17 seasons, maybe?
Boy, yeah, to season 17.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wonder if they actually got that $1 million for that. But
I really want to know, yeah.
Yeah.
Went right to Scientology.
April 21st, David Cohen signs an official two-year multi-million dollar development deal to produce Futurama as one of the showrunners with Matt Groening. They also mentioned in the article that it's planned that Futurama will debut after the Super Bowl next year.
And they make a joke about how they were screwed out of that.
Yep, yeah. They, I mean, it was pretty shitty to take that away from them for something I'm going to mention later.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the week of April 26th in general and in Variety and other publications was full of tons of articles because the 200th episode had come out. So if you'd love to read like with a season 10 staff commenting on hitting 200 episodes and them looking back then at the show, there's multiple really, really great articles in there. There's one about working with Alf Clausen on writing the music for it. There's one with all the writers of like, how do they do it? The writers. And lots of other celebratory things. They have a joke in there. In it, they print the story we've heard on many commentaries. Dave Merkin joking, we hit the halfway point.
Yeah.
Which it's not even the third waypoint now. And as part of that spate of new articles, on April 23rd, Variety has new reporting interviewing all the voice actors about their new deals. Now, most people in it, guess who I'm not talking about. But most people in it, pretty positive, or at least team players like Dan Castellan. I was like, everybody works hard on this, and we're just happy to get, you know, some recognition from the company. The show's made $500 million. We all work hard. Julie Cavanaugh's like, I work super hard. Dancy Cartwright even promotes like a film that her production company was working on at the time, which I doubt actually happened. Mm. But they're all talking up things. But most interesting to me was Harry Shearer being not diplomatic. Every time I read Harry Shearer stuff, I'm like, you're a crab, but I agree with you mostly.
Ultimately, he is right, even though he is a very wealthy man.
Yes, yeah. And so these are some fun quotes from them asking him about the raise they got. Quote, I find it ironic that a cast deemed instantly replaceable weeks ago is now indispensable as they're giving all these 200th episode interviews. Continues, a large number of working voice actors declined Fox's invitation to replace us. They are the ones who acted responsibly. We've been caught in an unpleasant fandango. Mm.
Ooh, an unpleasant fandango.
Yes, yeah.
That's always bad.
I love that he talks up like, Fox didn't act responsibly. They just couldn't get other voice actors to take our jobs because work solidarity, brother. My favorite Shearer quote, and it is, quote, but like all people in the business know, digging coal still is worse. I do not denigrate the show. I've been proud to be associated with it. Sadly, it fits as an anomaly in comedy history. It sets one trend in motion. It taught the networks and studios how much money there was to be made in animation, but I don't see any evidence that people followed the trail it blazed in smart, funny comedy. Mm. Thinking people like to draw their own conclusions, and there's a big audience for smart, funny comedy. But the business took animation another way. It stands as a lonely beacon.
Aww.
And that's a general point that they make in this and another article, is that it is definitely cheap to make this show compared to other shows. Like, and so April 24th, so much news. April 24th in the same week, Fox announces that they are changing their focus on Simpsons merchandise, which we all noticed in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah, for 2000s. Sure.
Explicitly a less kid-focused product. Quote, Rosanna McCulloch, who is the vice president of marketing in Fox's licensing and merchandising division, at least in 1998, we're taking a long-term lifestyle approach to The Simpsons to provide new licensees and to re-energize existing licensees. It's, 1998 was a big-ass moment of just Fox realizing that they don't sell Simpsons to children anymore, that the children grew up and they need to sell it to older teens and older. That's when in like 99, that's when you started seeing like the McFarlane toys of Simpsons.
The world of Springfield toys were the Playmates toys. And those are the ones that came in the yellow packaging, and they all could interact with play sets that you put them on. They had like a little chip in them.
And they were selling books like that, like The Complete Guide, that were like, you're a nerd who wants to catalog all these things. And that's why the video games grew up too. Like, all these things grew up. It was interesting to see that it took around the 200th episode that Fox internally was like, oh, we know how to sell The Simpsons better now. They finally got what was really the truth since the beginning, is like, kids do love The Simpsons, but so do older people, and now those kids are grown up.
Yeah, that's around the time I got Simpsons Monopoly. Mm-hmm. And what really annoyed me about this era of merchandise is, like, they did not crack the code on the graining font, but they're like, this Comic Sans is kind of similar. And so much Simpsons merch of this era has Comic Sans as the font. And actually, this is related, by the way. This is not a tangent, but because I'm watching Bob's Burgers with my girlfriend, we started in season 3 because that's where she left off, so I've been watching from the beginning. Season 1 uses Comic Sans as the font, and I was like, no wonder I didn't want to watch this show. That's a mark of, like, they didn't care. But they got their own font then in season 2 and onward, so...
Pay an artist to make a font, guys.
Or just buy a fucking font.
Yeah.
Don't use a free font everyone hates.
So, May 27th, Phil Hartman is killed by his wife in his sleep.
And we don't have to linger on that because we talk a lot about it in the next episode.
Yeah, Bart the mother. You can hear a lot more about it. But that also happens during season 9. July 20th, then, sees Phil Roman sign a deal with Fox to create 13 episodes of some bullshit called Family Guy.
Oh. Yep.
Yep. It was announced right then, like 3 months after the deal was made for Futurama, the show that would be cheaper than Futurama, get the time slot after The Simpsons, get the Super Bowl thing too. Clearly, somebody at Fox was a bigger fan of Family Guy than Futurama.
Oh, yeah. And go back to, so on our trip, I just discovered an article online I never read before. It's Matt Groening. It's an interview with Mother Jones, the magazine, the online website. Yeah. It takes place around this time. I think it's before the premiere of Futurama, and you can read about all of his struggles with getting it on the air that you hear on the DVDs, but it's even more explicit. This is printed before the show aired. Maybe they didn't help him too much.
No, I mean, you don't win friends with salad like that.
Yeah,
But meanwhile, you've got Seth MacFarlane who's like, I'm just young and stupid. Yes, sir. Like, I'll do what you want, and I'm way cheaper.
I'm young and cheap. The youngest showrunner on Fox or whatever.
Yeah, means he probably does what he's told. And I would figure the pilot of Futurama probably cost more than like the first four episodes of Family Guy.
Oh, yeah. That first season of Family Guy looks like trash. Yes, it's like disgusting.
Seth MacFarlane would be the first to say that too.
And people worked hard on it, but it was just like getting everyone, you know, working together on what the show should be.
Mm. Yeah, they didn't really fit. I think it wasn't until season three of Family Guy that it finally looks like something, even though I would never hyper praise. I love American Dad, but even that, I wouldn't praise the animation all that much on it. They do good work. I don't want to be mean to any cool animators out there.
There's only so much you can do with those kinds of characters.
They can't
move.
Yeah. Like,
they're meant to look in one direction.
How do you turn them into 360 or have any fun poses with them? But anyway, yes. So that was July 20th when Family Guy officially got a production company. And I mean, also with that kind of rush, like, they had an episode ready for the Super Bowl. No wonder the first episode is such a messy looking thing. All right, almost done. July 23rd, it's announced that Rupert Murdoch will be making an appearance on The Simpsons in season 10.
The billionaire tyrant?
Yes.
He's in on the joke, folks.
So many laughs, so many. I look forward to Sunday Cruddy Sunday in our podcast soon enough. I would bet we're going to get Cat Bailey for that one.
Oh, we have to get somebody who knows about sports.
Yes, yeah. And then finally, the last bit of news, and one that shocked me to find it in Variety, because I thought this was like a secret thing. August 17th, the WGA West, meaning the Writers Guild of America West, reaches a deal to make Simpsons a union show, which it was not before then.
Yeah, we actually heard this from Bill Oakley in person at the Portland show in October, and I thought, like, is this a secret? But then I thought, oh no, they'd have to like report this would be public knowledge, you know, if it's a union matter. So yeah, I guess before season 10 this was not they didn't got the union benefits or anything like that.
Yeah, which I mean, I guess I'd always been confused about that, because, you know, on the commentaries I know Al Jean and others straight up said, like, we use this freelancer because union blah 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 says we need to give a certain number of scripts to freelancers every year.
My guess is, like, you just, that's how you do it on a sitcom, regardless of if you're in union or not. Maybe they wanted to play by the rules so they be like, hey, WGA, make us a union show too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it could be Gracie wanted to respect those things, even if you know, Fox wasn't. But yeah, the situation up until August 17th, 1998 was that Fox did not recognize a union on the show, and it was not a union show, so they didn't get, you know, the union minimums. They didn't get residual deals on reruns, another thing that makes that show way cheaper, and why Fox loves syndicating The Simpsons.
Yeah, and it makes explains why so many people left. You know,
oh yeah, totally.
At the end of season four, it's like, we're getting nothing from this. We're getting paid well as writers, but none of the benefits of the show's success.
They see all their writer friends who are working on union shows like fucking, let's say, ER and Seinfeld that enter into syndication around the same time. They're getting crazy rich, or they're just like in these big residual checks in the mail for reruns, and Simpsons isn't getting it. Like, writers who worked on the golden years of the show, they were paid well enough then, I'm sure, but they don't get the benefits that a lot of other writers from then got on other shows, which really means residuals on reruns.
I wonder if how that works, and maybe we can ask one of the writers, that if any of the old content is grandfathered into the union agreement.
I don't think it
cover preseason 10 stuff? Could, like, Jeff Martin be getting residuals from, like, Barbershop Quartet or something?
I don't think so.
I have to wonder.
All right, but so that finally is all the Simpsons news that happened during season 9.
News.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. I couldn't believe how much there was.
We had a scrounge in some years.
And as for awards, the only big awards they got were in for season 9 were awarded on August 31st. First off, Hank Azaria won an Emmy for voice performance. So, hey, good for you, Hank Azaria. And he won that right around when he was cast as Nervous Eric or Stressed Eric.
Oh, Stressed Eric. Yeah, Klaus Kitschupo. We're going to mention it once again. We walked by their possibly abandoned building that was last painted with mural characters in, I don't know, 1993.
Stressed Eric is echoing down the halls there. But Hank Azaria was like the second voice for Eric because it was a British show, but they're like, no, it's got to have an American voice on the show.
I think that he was the only character they redubbed.
I think so, yes. Which, in that, it makes it a different show of like, oh, he's an American going crazy in England. And also, though, not just Hank Azaria, but another Emmy winner that year were Alf Clausen and Ken Keeler winning it for their song Checkin' In.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Yeah, you never think of that as a Simpsons standout song, but it is very clever.
I love that song, yeah. And I believe that's the song that beat Mr. Show.
Oh, it could be, yeah.
Or a Mr. Show song.
Yeah.
They never got to win an Emmy for all their songs. Even Y'all Are Brutalizing Me.
But they get a Peabody at least. That's like the Mystery Science Theater Award.
Yeah, it's the gift of guys like, well, you're smart. You won't win Emmys, but we like you.
You're too smart for an Emmy. Have a Peabody.
So commercials released in season 9. There's a few interesting ones here. After a few years off, they, I guess, renewed their contract with Butterfinger and so did a whole new slate of Butterfinger commercials, which you'll all find on the season 9 DVDs. My favorite is the first one that includes Kang and Kodos.
They
kidnap Bart to steal his Butterfinger, and then he convinces them to kidnap Homer instead at the end. And in it, they even use the Sister Kang joke.
Cool. I've always liked the Butterfinger commercials for their animation.
Yeah,
they're very well
done. That was the only American commercials, but Australian fans knew that they got Simpsons in the CC Chips commercials, not to be confused with CC Lemon, the Japanese drink.
They were popular sponsors for CC related food and beverages.
I think they're not the same company or anything.
I don't think so.
But yes, CC Chips, which also, like, I would have always figured Australians would call them crisps, like Brits do, but they are potato chips.
Yeah, we call them chips here, buddy.
And so the commercials were a series of dares. Like, they ran through season 9 and season 10, or at least the years of them, 98 to 2000. In them, Bart dares Homer to do something and to get chips from him. And one of them is like cliff diving. Another is Homer has to streak through the power plant. And the tagline at the end is like, chips, you just can't say dough to.
I like it.
And you get to see a lot of Homer's ass in them, too.
It's
a lot
of Australia.
Homer butt. Yeah. They have different rules there.
That's a better tagline than their Nito.
Yes. But those are the only Simpsons ads. I thought it was this season, but it's in season 10 is the Intel Pentium ad. So we'll chat about that then. Lastly in the news section, ratings.
So I didn't cheat this time.
Okay. Well, before I ask you, let me just say that the overall ratings for the season, not good. People talk about Simpsons decline, but this is a quantifiable decline, which is that it was definitely down from season 8. There are many episodes, multiple episodes, that went under 10 million viewers, which never happened on Simpsons. Like, season 8 and 9 did not have one that went under 10 million viewers.
And now they get like a million viewers. Yeah,
they get free. It's like a party town.
It's like it's a post-Super Bowl episode.
And yes, there are multiple episodes that go below 10 million viewers, and that gets even worse in season 10. So definitely there is a decline in ratings going on for The Simpsons. All right, so highest episode, Bob, what do you think it is?
It's got to be the 200th episode.
You would think that, but I thought that too, but it is not that. That would have been my guess for how much they promoted it, and it had the biggest stars on it.
What would it have been? The season premiere?
It's actually the one right after the season premiere, unbelievably.
But that's a weird
the
spot.
The Principal and the Pauper got 14.9 million viewers,
were
the
people
highest
just,
rate of the season.
Were people like fixated on the premise? Like, I got to find out.
I don't know. Or they were running hot off of the... Or it could have been like a big baseball game, and everybody just stayed tuned in. It could have been that. The Wikipedia, I am saying it's Principal and the Pauper because I could find two sources that confirm it. Wikipedia does say that the two Miss Nahas and Pima Petalons is actually the highest rated. It says 19.8 million, but that is an impossibly high number for that season.
Yeah, and that time too, that time period.
And so my double check on it was that the TV Tango website that has very reliable Nielsen ratings, they put it at 11.6 million that episode. Mm. Well, meanwhile, TV Tango had basically the same reportage for Principal and the Pauper. So I feel pretty safe in saying Principal and the Pauper was the highest rated of the season.
I like it. I think we redeemed that episode with our live show.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
We got original Bill Oakley video out of that, too.
I think Bill and Josh need feel no shame over that very good episode. Boy, what a highlight of season 9 for us that was.
That's true, yeah.
Big time fun that
doing
one was.
Doing Sketchfest. I say so the worst
yes,
one. Let me
lowest
guess.
Rated.
It's always so arbitrary, but I'm going to say, let me think, Dumbbell Indemnity.
You are right to go later in the season.
Usually around like April or like March.
It is an April episode, but not Dumbbell.
Oh, This Little Wiggy.
No, nope.
That was probably March. I don't know.
It's Trouble with Trillions.
Oh, that's a good one.
Those two were really close. I mean, also like ratings do not necessarily equal quality.
No,
we all know. But yes, Trouble with Trillions aired April 5th, got 7.4 million viewers. So a bit low, definitely, for Simpsons. I mean, it's almost exactly half of what Principal and the Pauper got in ratings. Like, so that's pretty bad decline from year to year.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's kind of, you think about how they had to become a union show, the ratings were going down, the actors wanted more money. It's, you know, this feels like the closest to the bubble of being canceled that Simpsons would have been.
You could see why they were making stories with the thought like, oh, we're going to have like a few years left. Who cares? Let's try anything. And then we're 20 years past that now. But they honestly thought like, this is probably the end. Mm-hmm. The show will run until like 2000 or 2001 and that'll be it. We are the 90s show.
They were all so experienced in TV that this is the decline that leads to a cancellation. Whether you're still doing good work or not, ratings wise, you keep going down like that, you get canceled.
And they watch Seinfeld go away. Like, well, we have to be next. We're the other institution on TV.
When I look at these stats, it gives me new reason to think that why internally some Simpsons producers don't like Principal and the Pauper, because it is a direct corollary downturn from that high down well, after that episode.
I got to tell you something, Henry. Correlation does not equal causation, as we all know in our logic classes.
Is this the David Cohen here?
Hello, Henry.
But yes, if I was looking at stats and reasons to blame Principal and the Pauper, I would say, look, see, we had this high with that. It was such an audience insulting episode that it made 7 million people stop watching The Simpsons.
Wow.
That you could make that argument in a boardroom.
I would not, sir.
I never would. It would not be fair. All right. Best and worst episodes, our personal picks for season 9.
It's unfair, so I've got a few best, because my best one is actually The City of New York versus Homer Simpson, thinking about how much I like the season. It's the first episode, so it's hard to remember. We did that like back in December, I think we recorded it.
Yes.
But one of Bill and Josh's best episodes, Jim Reardon was directing. It was a holdover, so they had extra time to work on it. It's beautiful. It's a great vacation episode.
I think it's the best animated of the whole season, for sure.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's my pick for best of season 9 overall, but it's not fair because Mike Scully is the season showrunner, so my runner-up for that is The Cartridge Family. It's still super funny and super relevant, and I hope I didn't take steal your fire there.
Well, no. Okay. My number one, actually, I almost picked New York as well, which this, you're right, we are being cruel to Mike Scully in his season to pick a Bill and Josh one, but we're Bill and Josh fanboys. It's who we are. Let's own that. But Principal and the Pauper actually is my number one. I hate to sound contrarian, but when I looked back on the season, like, I think it's the richest in themes and full of very funny jokes.
And very touching. Like, nothing was as touching as that episode. Scully was not a huge fan of that. And when he tried to go for it, it just didn't feel as sincere.
Yeah, I think it, it finds a lot of fun to do with Skinner, and there's layers to it. It's worth revisiting, and there's just so many great jokes in it I would return to. I laughed so hard at the line, like, well, I guess you had to be there, that finally really hit me of like, oh, he's talking about being held captive.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, my runner-up too is Cartridge Family. I think it is the best written Scully one of the season. It has the funniest ideas. I think also too, you know, you have your most energy when it's your first episode as showrunner. And I think, it had a lot to say about guns in America that was still very smart at the time too. And, you know, the gun debate has only become more complex, but it's also full of Swartzwelder-y craziness too. And I think it's one of the most quoted episodes that Mike Scully worked on.
I'd kill you if I had my gun. Well, you don't.
All right, worst, our least favorite episode.
Nothing stands out as like particularly bad. Like season 8 had a clear not so great one in there. Season 9, if I had to guess, I would probably say it could just be fresh in my memory, but Girly Edition. It's kind of like we use the term Rugratsy, where it's just like, what if kids did adult thing? And it's like you make the joke as like, this equals this, kids stuff equals adult stuff. And it's fun, and there are fun jokes in there, but Lisa's not very likable. And the whole story is like, well, no, Bart is good at this. Mm-hmm. Local news is not like a quality institution. Bart is good at being like a shitty huckster on the local news, selling these public interest stories. Like, and Lisa is mad about that, and it's just unpleasant.
No, it again feels like the many times they have to tear down Lisa for liking something. Plus, I mean, the monkey stuff's funny though.
The monkey stuff is good. We got Pray for Mojo, but
and a crazy cat lady.
Yeah, but the A story, I mean, it's not like nothing stands out as particularly bad in this season, but it just kind of sat there for me.
Well, I think you erased from your memory the Gene and Reese episodes from this season.
Oh, I was going to say, well, Simpson Tide would be my least favorite, but that's my number one least favorite. Number two would be Realty Bites, because it's like, I feel like I have to also judge Scully, which I praise him.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't like Lisa's. Going back at it, I was like, Lisa Sachs is my least favorite, because I think they have, you know, they got the flashback premise. So, you know, Gene and Reese are going over their greatest hits, some of their best episodes from their years, where the flashback episodes, they wrote the first flashback episode The Way We Was.
Yeah, it's true.
And so they're doing it again, but Lisa Sachs like has almost none of the depth. Like, it also kind of forgets what year it's even set in.
Yeah.
Which, like, that's the whole fucking point of doing this.
The air conditioning plot makes no sense.
Yeah, it just slams into you in the third act. Plus, there's so many scenes that just, like, waste time. Like, the funky grandpa scene, Apu. Just felt like they were short, you know?
I feel like a real trademark of their episodes as satellite showrunners are just, like, too many parodies. It's like they're still in critic mode, where it's like, the critic didn't really tell any real stories. It was more about the parodies, and they sort of got in too much into that mode when writing their Simpsons episodes after that.
Yeah. And also that Lisa Sachs has a clip bit in it too of Al Jean's favorite episodes. And second is Simpson Tide, which also I feel like is a weak episode that forgets its plot halfway through.
Yeah.
That also is so reliant on a film no one remembers.
It's true. It was an odd parody again, but it was like those episodes were written 2 years before they aired.
So
it was an odd time to be that specific for those references.
It might have hit better if they'd come out in 96 instead of 98. If I were to pick a worse Scully one, maybe it would be Girly Edition, I think. Though, man, I just don't. Jerkass Homer is all over this season. Those are like my lowest moments of him being cruel.
I thought you were a non-believer in Jerkass Homer.
No, I mean, he's a jerk. Jerkass Homer is a wrong title because he didn't get created this season.
Right.
But Homer is cruel all over the place in this.
Yeah. I prefer if we just call him, this is my house rule. I don't want to call him Jerkass because it propagates the narrative that he was created in The Joy of Sect.
Yes.
When he has been Jerkass on and off throughout the run of the series.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Mean Homer.
Mean Homer, there we go. Now I'm being a jerkass.
As Lisa and Bart called him, a big meanie in the Forrest Gump clip show.
Oh, yeah, can't wait for that.
Yep. All right, so those are our least favorites. Now, season MVP, as in the character we felt throughout all of broadcast season 9, had the best jokes or best episodes. Like, previous winners were like, you know, Groundskeeper Willie, Barney, Milhouse, Barney.
I've got a surprise. My breakout character or MVP is Gil.
Oh, of course.
Because they found Gil in their Glengarry Glen Ross parody, and then they fell in love with him. He only appeared a few more times, but by the end of this season, Gil is where he will be for the rest of the series, where he's like living in a hot air balloon, making payments on a hot plate. You know, just destitute.
Yes. So yeah, they, like, he gets you hot cha cha, and you're, and when he's like singing in that scene too, it's when Gil becomes like the just let Dan do some stuff.
Yeah. If you go back to our Realty Bites episode, you're like, wow, Gil is like very low key. It's just like a very low key Jack Lemmon. But by the time you get to Natural Born Kissers, he is amped all the way up. He's a cartoon version of that, and he's I like Gil. He's fine.
Once they establish him in the Trouble with Trillions, like, doesn't Gil get a lick?
Yeah,
he's so sad. Yeah.
I mean, in Realty Bites, it's established that he has a home because he brings one of the walls from it
cubicle. And when he works at the shoe store, you pointed out there's one joke that doesn't work as well because the joke is not on him. It's on him giving a gross sock to somebody else. Yeah.
Gil should always be humiliated in every scene.
So my season MVP, I agree with your pick. It's actually the right pick. But mine is Mo.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. There's our first Mo episode in a long time, right?
Yeah. Mo's all over the place in this season. But I mean, you get Dumbbell Indemnity, a Mo featuring Siri episode, which is like he finally gets happiness with Hank Azaria's real life lover. Plus he just has so many great jokes this season, like, if you can't tell us what it ain't, how about you tell us what it ain't?
I do love that. Yeah.
Or also him saying, like, well, I am desperate to sell my house, gimme, in Realty Bites.
Well, monoxide him.
Oh god, yes. Yeah, him pulling a shotgun on Homer, the first of the he pulls a shotgun on Homer jokes. His rat care in the New York episode, like him hanging out with the rats and then also telling everybody that they're responsible for 98% of the drunk driving in the entire city. And of course, let's say Mo.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say Mo about it. So he became the guy you go to, like, sure, let's say Mo.
He became much more of a scumbag.
Yes. And he's not as suicidal as he would later get in other
seasons. No, I think...
So suicide is there.
Yeah.
Sure.
Once Dana Gould jumps on board, the suicide jokes really ramp up.
But yes, that is why Mo, with a strong comeback this season, they find new things for Mo in season 9. And I think that's why, you know, old favorites like Groundskeeper Really or Skinner kind of fall to the background because they feel like they fully define them. They can't find a new corner for them.
Yeah.
For Mo, they turn a new corner on him.
Yeah, not nearly as much Skinner with Mike Scully. And he's sort of like, he's less of the lovable, boring guy that Oakley and Weinstein made him into.
Yeah, when he appears in Bart the Mother, I'm like, oh yeah, Skinner. But I don't think they have as much like, obviously Bill and Josh love Skinner. They love how lame he is. And I've said it before, I think Skinner in with him and Edna is an avatar for Bill Oakley. Like,
yeah.
I do think that. But so I can understand why the next guy would be like not as into Skinner. Every writer has their favorites. So that's not no blame there. But yeah, I think Mo really came into their own. I think, you know, maybe it helps that, like Dana Gould, a lot of the writers see their mean drunken fathers in Mo.
That helps, yeah.
Yeah.
So yes, thanks for joining us. So our season 9 wrap up. Like we said, we've done every one of the seasons except for one because we were learning how to podcast still. But yes, you can go back and check this out on the Patreon. And there's a deleted scene special coming up too around the corner. Again, sorry for doing these a little bit after season 9 ended, but we had that long trip in LA and I've been traveling a lot too. So we're trying to get this extra stuff out as soon as we can. So we appreciate your patience with it. I don't think anyone has asked about like where it is. So no one is angry yet. So that's good.
But yes, we appreciate your patience anyway. And all your continued support through season 9 into season 10. Let's keep that going. And there's so many other cool things coming on the Patreon in the future. And man, we're starting season 10 off with a bang with tons of great guests that we got in Hollywood.
Yes, we're staying in Holly Weird. They just renamed it, by the way. But yes, lots of stuff to look forward to, so please do that, and we'll see you in about 6 months for another episode of the season wrap-up. So see you then.
My legs hurt.